Hello, everyone. Welcome to Struggle Session. I'm Leslie the Third.
I'm Jack Allison.
And today, in this time, you know, when so much is going on, there's so many things that you're seeing in the media that are so disturbing. I saw this video of a nice, you know, cop that was just trying to get an Egg McMuffin.
Oh, yeah.
And
cops, I mean, out there, they can't. It's a very scary time for them. There's like so many different fast food meals that they can be, that they, you know, want to get while on duty. Then, you know, it just doesn't feel safe. Doesn't feel safe out there to be getting milkshakes and Egg McMuffins, you know, in these times.
Because they're afraid that someone's going to do something like a little bit mean, a little bit nasty, play some kind of dirty joke on them with their food. Some kind of trickster out there will do something to their Egg McMuffin.
Right.
And today we're talking about someone who's played a character, a fictional character now. You know, so it is okay for you to listen to this, but I do want to give you fair warning. We're talking about a fictional character that has done a lot of mean things to cop over, over the years. Played a lot of very cruel and mean jokes on them. And I just wanted to warn everyone before we get too deep into this episode that, yes, this is an episode about the most dangerous fictional character of all time.
A name that some don't even like to hear spoken, is how scary this, you know, Warner Brothers, AT&T owned fictional character is.
Today we're talking about the Joker.
The clown prince of crime himself.
Yes, the bad clown. The clown that was bad and mean to people, especially cops. We're talking about him today, and we have a very special guest joining us. She is a director and editor, award-winning director and editor, who has taken on the task. And I don't know, maybe this is an episode, maybe we can talk her out of it, because what she is planning to do is to make yet another Joker film, taking her award-winning editing skills to create a brand new Joker film, specifically during the time of the coronavirus, using archival footage of the Jokers that already exist, along with new stuff.
Wow.
It's a project called The People's Joker. It's very, you know, exciting and interesting, but also like very scary because it's about the Joker.
Yeah.
Vera Drew, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on, guys. Yeah, it feels like now more than ever, I shouldn't be tackling a character that could be potentially tampering with fast food items. It just seems kind of inappropriate.
Or at least inspiring people to maybe pull pranks on police. You know, I really, as we're talking about it, I'm like, you know, the Killing Joke really is the ultimate cop prank, you know. That's like the McDonald's food thing taken to a whole different level.
Yeah.
So we will be talking about two of the most famous Joker comic books of all time, Alan Moore and Brian Bolland's The Killing Joke, as well as Grant Morrison's and Dave McKean's Arkham Asylum, A Serious House on Serious Earth. But before we get into those, Vera, can you please tell us about The People's Joker?
So comedian Brie LaRose, she was a writer on Arrested Development and Magic for Humans, actually commissioned me to make my own edit of Todd Phillips' Joker for $12. She did it like a few months ago, which is about...
Editing really has bottomed out at this point. I mean, geez.
I champion workers' rights, but this is just the reality, you know, we're in right now, and the industry shutting down.
Yeah, fair enough.
But you know, I started to kind of like do just kind of like a... I work primarily with Tim and Eric, so I kind of did like a Tim and Eric edit of it, and it was funny, and like, I think people would love to see it, but like, I kind of, as I was working on it, I was like, you know, I kind of just want to make my own Joker movie.
Wow.
Because I don't know, like, I liked, and I appreciated your guys' review of the one that came out last year, because I didn't hate it. by
the Todd Phillips cut.
That's his version. I have no issues with it, and that's not why I'm doing this. But I think one thing that like has been really frustrating for me, just watching so many portrayals of the Joker, is that like queerness has never really been explored. Mm-hmm. Because to me, like Joker and Batman's relationship, maybe not like completely overtly like romantic, there is some serious like homoeroticism to it. I think the fact that gender or like Joker is a character that you can really project anything onto, there's really no reason why, you know, they can't be like explored in like a gender mm-hmm. way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, I kind of just decided to start writing a new movie, uses footage from the 2019 mm-hmm. movie and pretty much any time Joker's popped up, and I'm writing basically just like long story short, like what it's like to work in comedy and be trans.
Love it. This is fully endorsed and licensed by the Warner Brothers company, right?
I have not gotten anybody's permission. I'm also I'm using Jared Leto's likeness in this film as well. He portrays a character. He doesn't play the Joker. I play the Joker.
Right.
Okay.
Jared Leto plays a character that I'm calling in the movie Mr. J, who is like an abusive ex-boyfriend of mine.
Mr. J.
Yeah. And I haven't officially reached out to Jared yet.
Well, he has been busy.
He's been in like on desert sabbaticals and shit like that, right?
He didn't even know about this whole COVID thing coming on until
you might honestly just be able to sneak this past Jared. And honestly, he might come out of like, you know, like being in a tent in the desert and like actually think he just was in this movie. He might be like, oh, that's out finally. Thank God. Here it is.
Yeah. I mean, the way I see it is like, if he wants to be involved, he totally should, because he wants to play the Joker again. Like he said that he was very upset that Todd Phillips cast Joaquin. Mm-hmm. So this is his chance. And if he doesn't like it, then this can be his way of making it up to the trans community for doing Dallas Buyers Club.
Yes. I as much as I love my boy Jared, I gotta say, you know, that was a fuckboy move. Yeah, he was one of the last. Was he one of the last like big time straight male celebrities that would play a trans woman, or was Eddie Redmayne a little bit later? I think Hollywood has finally figured out you can't do that anymore, but Jerry, you do owe it to Vera and the trans community to participate in this,
right?
Because I'm representing the trans community, I guess, with this movie is the implication I'm making.
Yeah. There was an election, right? And you were elected to make the Joker movie, right?
Yeah, that was my job. there's other stuff I could do, guys. No.
So let's talk for a minute about the Joker, because I feel like we've talked about the Joker, but not really about, like, we haven't really gotten to the bedrock of what this character is or isn't, and what makes them such a appealing and enduring character. I mean, it seems kind of silly that like a bad clown is the might like survive humanity. Like, there'll still be Joker stuff around after humans are no longer around, right? Yeah. I feel like that's fairly a safe thing to say. The aliens, when they come and they dig through the wreckage, they'll see, you know, they might pull out a copy of Suicide Squad or Tim Burton's Batman, or perhaps, you know, Batman Beyond, Return of the Joker, and they'd be like, oh, this is kind of cool. These humans were kind of onto something. So what what is it? I think we're all fans of the Joker. If we can just go around and talk about what makes the Joker so appealing to us.
You know, I guess one thing that is very appealing about the Joker to me is what you said, Vera, that, you know, this is a character that can, like, withstand so many different interpretations, kind of like the Batman character itself. Like, you know,
yeah.
I don't know, like, you know, of all these kind of like corporate owned characters that are, you know, basically just like licenses that get passed around by companies at this point, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, the Joker, it's what, you know, artists and writers have like brought to the characters over the years. And I think, like, you know, that Joker is such a blank slate, you know, is what makes the character inspire so many different interpretations or something like that. So, you know, I think that I actually even think Joker can, you know, contain more interpretations even than like the Batman character can. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think like Joker has kind of weirdly de facto become our, like, you know, America's most insidious villain or something, maybe just because he's so prevalent in pop culture and still such a blank slate.
Yeah, and I think that's why there was so much, last year was so weird, like the lead up to the movie, like how the media like completely like wanted there to be like an active shooter situation. But like I think that kind of comes from that same idea, right? Because like it's also there's different interpretations on where he comes from, like there's different philosophies attached to like every Joker, like, and that's a terrifying prospect because you can kind of ascribe anything to this scary clown.
Man. Yeah, like, because, like, Heath Ledger's Joker is considered, like, some sort of, like, almost lefty anarchist-type figure, but deeply, like, pessimistic. When you have, you know, Jack Nicholson's Joker, which is basically just, like, a gangster, flamboyant gangster.
Yeah. Right?
and then you get to, you know, maybe a little bit of Jared's kind of Joker, which is more, leans on more, like, the kind of serial killer, you know, creepy serial killer type Joker. I think, you know, you have, like, I want to say that, you know, Jokerism is a spectrum and all Jokers are beautiful. All these different interpretations.
I even think the mustached Joker on the 60s show.
Yeah, Caesar.
With the makeup. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was good too.
Yeah, just the prankster criminal, the guy who just wants to, you know, do a bunch of gags. Like, that's a Joker as well. And you kind of see all the Jokers interact. They're all in a dialectic with one another. So I hate to see how some people, and I think we've gone away from this, thankfully, how some people have been trying to, you know, separate out the Jared Joker and say, oh, he's the bad Joker. No, the most beautiful image on the internet is the image of Cesar Romero's Joker driving the car with Jack Nicholson Joker, with Heath Ledger Joker, with Jared Leto Joker, and they say, oh, all right, we're going to pick up Joaquin Joker. I think that's one of the most beautiful images on the internet.
Yeah, that is pretty inspiring. You know, we really can come together. Maybe if all the Jokers can come together, America can still come together.
People are so protective of the character too, in kind of a obnoxious way. I mean, like, because I unironically like Suicide Squad. Like, I totally recognize why it's a bad movie, and why people like don't like it.
Yeah.
Do you want the Goyer cut? Do you want there to be a Goyer cut?
I would pay thousands of dollars to, like, I think the sort of like insane serial killer gangster Joker is like one that I really, really want to see. And I think that's what's appealing to me about Jared's Joker. So
yeah.
I would pay good money to see the the footage that has been left out of the movie.
Yeah, that's kind of my favorite Joker, too. It's the Joker that, you know, it kind of is in The Dark Knight Returns. That's Frank Miller's preferred take on the Joker in The Dark Knight Returns, and also, I think, All-Star Batman. He's the one, he's the first one who put, like, tattoos on the Joker. The Joker in All-Star Batman has, like, this big, like, Japanese, like, Yakuza, like, full-on Yakuza tattoo on his back, and he's, like, a hitman that's a clown, too, for some reason. And what else? Brian Azzarello's, he, around The Dark Knight, he put out a graphic novel with art by Lee Bermejo, just called Joker, which I think we'll talk about sometime, but it's actually really interesting.
That's pretty good. I remember he did a Lex one too, right?
He did a
Azzarello series.
Yeah, there was kind of a Azzarello like villains series. Yeah. His new, I don't think the new Batman one he did where he shows Batman's dick is any good. I didn't finish it, but his old Joker comic is pretty good. We'll talk about it sometime. But let's dive into our books today. Two of, you know, the most famous and well-regarded Joker comics, but they did come out, you know, relatively back, almost like back to back. It was like 1988 was The Killing Joke, which was and 1989 Arkham Asylum, written by Alan Moore and his fail son Grant Morrison, I have to say. and Jack, I'm not going to ambush you again,
yeah,
by making you defend Grant Morrison versus Alan Moore, because
I have never said that like Grant Morrison outdoes Alan Moore. I'm an Alan Moore I'm a fan. I'm an Alan Moore one. He won this thing. I just still like some Grant Morrison stuff.
But what I'm saying is I actually think this one is actually really fantastic, and this one Arkham Asylum is almost as good as like an Alan Moore comic, so I'm not gonna be trashing Grant Morrison today.
Wow.
we will be doing some Grant Morrison trashing later, though. Don't worry about it.
Okay good, thank God. All right,
so let's start with, you know, The Killing Joke, which I feel like because we went through that period during the Obama era where we kind of start reevaluating all our media through a very kind of liberal, narrow lens of problematic or not, and found everything was problematic. Like the actual craft of this comic got completely lost and thrown by the wayside, and people just talk about the problematic elements to sexism, but people don't really engage with the comic, at least in discussion anymore, whether it's good or not. It's just like it's canceled. And I feel, you know, rereading it today, like I never really thought that was fair. Maybe that's my narrow view of it, but I really think this is still a great comic book, even if Alan Moore doesn't like it anymore.
I have issues with it, but not, I mean, nobody hates performative wokeness more than me. But like my issues with it don't outweigh the things I really, really like about it. And like also, and definitely its place in like DC canon, because I feel like the take on it now, like when you bring up this book to people, like people are immediately like, oh, that's the book where Barbara Gordon gets raped. And I feel like that's maybe an implication
right in
the text, but like it's never overtly said.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like people are like the way people talk about it, I'm like, I don't know. Yes, it is kind of implied, but it's still like a DC comic. You know what I mean? You can also read it and not. You can say, like, I don't think that's what happened. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, and I also think, like, I don't think that's what happened, but that there is still still sexual violence what happened to both, you know, Barbara and James Gordon. Like,
right,
being stripped down and humiliated, that's sexual violence, too. You don't have to, you know, it is a very, you know, dark and creepy comic, and came in this point in time where people were making darker comics, and then a lot of people who weren't nearly as good sort of kind of imitated the stuff that they saw in The Killing Joke, and then that kind of backfired on the whole comic industry. And then Killing Joke, even though what it was doing was, you know, something different and innovative and well thought out, I think, for the most part, kind of got all that backlash put on it instead of like, you know, this or that crappy comic that kind of mimicked it.
You don't think that Green Lantern, Kyle Rayner, Green Lantern handled it as well when his girlfriend was chopped up and put in the fridge? You don't think it was like handled with as much like class?
Yeah, I don't think Alan Moore wrote that one. So maybe the direct association isn't 100% fair.
I think the problem I do have with what like happens in this book to Barbara Gordon specifically is I think it kind of, I mean, like exactly what you're saying. Like, I think like a lot of people try to write like more and just can't. But like, I feel like this book kind of like basically paved the way for like what I consider like some of the worst eras of comics. Yeah. And I mean, the era of Batman that I grew up in, like, it was so focused on the Bat family and, like, Oracle. And it's like, I fucking hated all those books so much.
Oh,
like,
really?
I'm not a Bat family. I'm not really a Batman person. But, like, I just don't. I could never get into it. Because to me, like, Batman was always, like, the solo. Like,
solitary figure, yeah.
Yeah, I don't
like,
need.
I agree. Like when I was a kid, you know, it was that same Bat family stuff. I never liked any of that shit. I liked the greatest Batman stories ever told comic or something that had like a bunch of sort of like one shot stuff from like the 60s and 70s. And I also had like Killing Joke. And I always liked that shit a lot more. I kind of agree with you. You didn't say this outright, but I'm like, I feel like one of the, like, the Killing Joke is really well written and handled really well and done smart. And then that it was in continuity in DC and like we had to like live with that being the way it is forever. And it like kind of lived on in the consciousness so much. I think maybe that was the mistake. I think maybe that was the mistake, was like living in this trauma forever. You know what I mean? Like this didn't have to be like an in continuity story. Like, let's just let Alan Moore do a big scary one shot and still have Batgirl. And now we're like 20 years later and they had to like reboot the universe for to have Batgirl again. It's like stupid.
Well, I disagree, Jack. I think I really like
Oracle.
Yeah, of course. Oracle ruled. Oracle is one like the best. I mean, it's like, and I talked about this on the Death Panel podcast. And I had to actually break the news to them that there was no longer Oracle, that the woke comic nerds actually were so upset about having a disabled superhero that they got rid of her to bring back like Barbara Gordon as Batgirl, who was not an active character at the time that the Killing Joke, you know, was written. That's why she was able to be shot, because she was no longer like a really active character, a big deal. And so when people were reacting to what they felt was, you know, the sexism and misogyny of, you know, all these female characters being killed, being depowered, like Batgirl was like the crown jewel in that. Like, but the thing was, she was still there. Barbara Gordon was still, she was Oracle for longer than she was Batgirl. Yeah. And so,
and I will say that Batgirl is not a very exciting or cool character, really, but fine.
Yeah, and it was strange because you had, you know, they thought there was this, you know, very, you know, a well-meaning liberal woke idea that we're going to undo this sexist thing that happened to this character. But the thing was, it's like, okay, now there's no, the most, you know, biggest, most well-known comic book character with a disability who's been in the video games, who's been in other stuff as Oracle, been that character for long as she was Batgirl, we're going to completely erase that and make her able body again, and that's supposed to be a victory. And I really, like, that really bothered me and bothered, you know, other people I told about it too. I really thought that was like not understand, that was not very intersectional of the woke nerds, as I would say. Yeah, and so getting into the actual Killing Joke comic, you mentioned that this is a big prank on a cop. I'll actually say I think maybe it's maybe you could say that this comic is about who what's a more evil institution, the police or stand-up comedy? Because these are the two forces directly opposed with one another, especially what's going on in the news these days. Like, this is today we're recording this on Wednesday.
Oh my
this
god,
stand-up comedy is the one that's that everybody's mad about, rightfully so. But yeah, so you have it's a kind of parallel narrative where Alan Moore gives you a possible, not a definite, but a possible origin story for the Joker, where he's the, you know, this failed stand-up comic that's unfunny, who is trying to put food on the table, take care of his wife.
Now listen, I think it's good, and it's like a good origin story kind of thing. But it was very funny to read someone who's like, I'm just trying to put food on the table for my wife. And I'm like, but you're like doing stand up. You know what I mean? I'm like, you're not ever going to make money doing like stand up, dude. Like, let's get real. Like, it is funny that there's this guy who's like, my main driving purpose is making money for my wife. And the way I'm going to do that is stand up comedy.
But I like it because it's like quaint and like comic
book-y. It's very comic booky. It's 1960s comics. Like, this is not the real world. It's a silly cartoon world. And, you know, the Joker's a part of that.
That's what I really like. How this one play, like, and I think that's what Alan Moore's usually pretty good at, is taking, like, you know, 100-year-old tropes and styles from comic books and then, you know, putting them into this insane world. Like, I love the idea of Joker being a failed stand-up comedian.
I
genuinely love too, because I think it speaks to how stupid he was too, like, for getting mixed up in the whole, like, the Red Hood gang and all that stuff. Like, I think you know, Chemical Fall Joker was a fucking idiot and, like, totally right. Got caught up in this, like, was already in over his head. And in a way kind of deserved everything that befell upon him. Like most, the fate of most comedians, I'd say.
This is what should happen to every comedian. They should all be dropped.
What I appreciate about Joker's story is that, like, he's just an idiot and, you know, he's well-meaning. And, I like that the Joker's origin in this is almost like what would be a 1960s origin for a superhero named the Joker. You know what I mean? Like, aside from the fact that he's involved in, like, a robbery or whatever, he really is just, like, a well-meaning guy who, like, gets scared by Batman into becoming the Joker.
it's kind of funny you say that, because now that I think about it, because a lot of the villains did have kind of parallel things, but like their original stories would be parallel to the superhero stories. They get knocked into the vat of chemicals, yada yada yada, but the villains would always use that to then, like, get revenge on people or make money, and the Joker and the superheroes would use their powers, you know, to go and help their, you know, common man. And the Joker kind of looks at it and just says, like, fuck the world, everybody, ACAB, all million dead people, like, all he just goes fucking sicko mode, and said doesn't really have any kind of plans. Infamously, Joker does not make plans, just says fuck it. Like, if this is what the world is like, where my wife can, you know, die from, what was it, she got electrocuted while, like, heating up, like, baby, like the
it was such a, I love it, it's like a very just, like, total accident, weird happenstance. Yeah, it's like she was using, like, a baby formula heating machine that blew up. I love that shit, actually. That's, like, one of the best parts about it.
Yeah, I like, every layer of how he becomes the Joker is just so insanely, like, it's comical. Like, I think that's what really works about this, and why, like, it also is interesting that, like, this is a villain origin story, because, like, it's that thin line between what's funny and, like, what's tragic and, like,
what
makes somebody nihilistic. And I feel like that is something we see in both comedy and tragedy. And, like, I don't know. I think there's something, it's almost like Coen Brothers-y, like, how,
oh yeah,
like, absurd and stupid it is. I don't know. It really works for me. Like I would take that over the Joker having some sort of like personal vendetta.
Yeah. It's also very hilariously, it's like it's a nature versus nurture story. This is like the Joker taking the nurture side of the argument, and Batman says, no, you, it's only a true sicko that becomes a sicko like you, Joker.
Yeah, I mean, if there's any problem with the premise of this book, and this book is the idea that Joker would have to do this much to turn James Gordon, a police, into a maniacal killer, like it would not take from what we're seeing in that, the real
right,
world.
Right, that James Gordon does not become a killer is unrealistic, but this is like a superhero cartoon universe or whatever.
Yeah, it's a sci-fi alternate dimension where cops can be good people. And like right. that's about it. And so the other parallel story is, you know, Batman, he's, you know, this is we're supposed to be, you know, he's been fighting with the Joker for a few years. He's realized that Joker is his most popular villain, and that it doesn't make sense that he keeps letting him get out of jail and prison and kill people. So eventually he's going to have to kill him, or the Joker is going to have to kill Batman, or they're basically in a dance to the death. And he's trying to come and meet Joker and come to some kind of understanding, while the Joker is just like fuck cops, fuck 12, and kidnaps James Gordon, shoots Barbara Gordon. He didn't know she was, you know, Batgirl at the time, and she had retired from it. And he just straight up, you know, caps her as soon as he opened the door, which is, you know, for all the problematicness of the idea of, you know how women are treated in comic books, I still think that's a really like effective and creepy like fucking scene. Like it's like this comic has just a lot of really good horror elements in it. I really like that scene. I like the how scary the modern Joker is, how like scared of him other people are. Like even Batman, when he meets the fake Joker in that interrogation scene, he's like, do you have any idea what you've unleashed? Like people are as scared of the Joker in this comic as people are in real life of the Joker.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow, the only thing that can compare.
Yeah, I think that I mean that's why I completely reject the criticism that, like, I mean, it's a stupid criticism to say that like women are treated more unfairly in this book than the men, because like I'm sorry, but like women are treated more unfairly in real life. And also like somebody as crazy as this dude like would do those things. Like I think it actually is really kind of pointing out the power that the character has, which is something that I think some authors actually screw up when they just turn him into like edgelord Joker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so his Joker's grand plan is to prove that, you know, all it takes is one bad day for even someone as upstanding as a Gotham City police officer to break bad, as it were, and become a killer. So he shoots Barbara, takes you naked photos of her, strips James Gordon naked, takes him through like this dilapidated funhouse. I wonder, is this where the idea that Joker is always like an owner of like a dilapidated amusement park? Like,
although it does feel very 60s Joker, you know? Yeah. What I mean, like, I think this might even come from like classic Silver Age Batman.
Yeah, I would think
taking over like a, you know, carnival or whatever.
Yeah, but now it's like everything, like even like the Harley Quinn movie, the last fight scene, which is very good, takes place in like a old amusement park. It's like there's an old amusement park district in Gotham, and for some reason nobody notices that, like,
well, amusement park boom. So there's a whole, you know, sector, and then the bottom fell out. So there's just a whole bunch of amusement parks over there.
But Brian Boland's art in this is like top notch. Some of the best art you'll ever see. He does same panel style that the Alan Moore used in Watchmen with the tiny panels. Right. But when he lets loose and opens those panels up, my God, it's just like when Batman breaks through the funhouse mirror at Joker. Like, it's just some of the most beautiful, you know, Batman and Joker images you'll ever see. But sadly, you know, James Gordon is not driven insane. In fact, he tells Batman, in probably the worst scene in the book, the least believable scene, he tells, "I want him brought in by the book."
Well, now, which is like some silly shit, because I'm like, dude, you're talking to like a bat dressed man. Yeah. I'm like, by what book are you talking about? For real.
I guess we're supposed to think that, all right, Batman, Joker has gone so far, he shot Batgirl, who, you know, who, even though James Gordon doesn't know and Joker don't know, you know, has this very, you know, close, intimate relationship with Batman, and this is going to put, maybe this will push Batman over the edge. But nope, he just kind of smacks him around a couple of times, arrests him, and then in a very strange move, Alan Moore move, the Joker tells Batman this really weird joke once he's captured about two escapees from an insane asylum who are trying to get away, but they don't trust each other enough to get away. But even if they did trust each other, they both end up dead anyway. And it's supposed to be, of course, a metaphor for the relationship of Batman and Joker, because in both this book and as well as, you know, Arkham Asylum, I think this was where the idea that Batman is supposed to be just as crazy, in scare quotes, crazy as, you know, that we used to use, you know, back in the 60s. He's supposed to be just as kooky and crazy as the Joker, and they're kind of two sides of the same coin. And this, and Alan Moore kind of leaned on this as well as Grant Morrison did. I never really necessarily bought, you know, the premise of that, but it's fun to explore. And I think, you know, Alan Moore and Grant Morrison later, as we'll talk, both do kind of a good job of, you know, suggesting that, you know, Batman, he's just as, you know, off his fucking rocker or whatever as the Joker is, if he's going around dressing as a bat and beating up clowns.
This is kind of where this book actually falls apart for me a little bit. I kind of just reject Alan Moore's like premise of insanity that, like, particularly in this reality that he even built, that like that somebody can be driven mad into the degree of madness that like the Joker's at in this particular book. Like, I don't know, because I do think there is something interesting to be discussed with you know, Batman being just as crazy as the people he's fighting, and I think Grant Morrison does a better job of that. But I don't know. There's something about, especially like with how vague the ending is, and the fact that it can be interpreted that did Batman kill him? Did Batman take him back to Arkham? It's like, to me, the nuance that can be explored in Batman being just as crazy as these villains is that he has compassion, you know, and that would also separate him from cops.
Yes, exactly. You
know? Like that, and that's never gotten to that point, but like, I mean, well, it's in some books it has, but like in this one particularly, I feel like that's where it kind of drops the ball. Like, that's where the nuance could have kind of been explored.
Yeah, I feel like there's kind of like two arguments, you know, being proposed, because I think the larger argument that Alan Moore makes about, you know, insanity, again, we're not using this in the technical way, but the idea that the reaction to our world, and Joker explicitly said this a few times, he gives a little, couple of little speeches where he talks about, you know, when you have a world full of starvation, famine, rape, war, the only rational, you know, response to that is irrationality, right? But that's kind of like a bigger argument than whether this particular guy named, you know, Jack or whatever would be driven mad by what happened to him, or that James Gordon could possibly be driven, you know, clinically insane by what happened to him. I think the larger point of like, our world is so fucked up that actually a person like the Joker is the only one who can actually, you know, you deal with it and survive it is very, you know, good and pretty relevant. I think it, you know, gets to the Jokerification theory proposed by Bugmane, as well as, you know, other people that, you know, if we're going to survive 2020, we got to get fucking Jokerified on some level or not. But I think that it, even though it's covering kind of the same ideas, you're very right about, like, it is kind of like a comic book conception of, you know, mental health and mental illness, but the kind of larger metaphorical argument, I think, is, you know, fairly sound, because our world is so fucked up that, like, the only person who can make any sense of it would be a Joker or Joker type figure.
Yeah, it's that whole that super sanity thing with the Joker of like that, and that's why, like, it kind of feels like maybe he knows he's in a story and stuff like that. Like, that, I don't know, that is very interesting. And that's, I mean, maybe that's actually what really works about it, is that, like, you can then have this conversation about it and it's kept vague. But
all right, so let's, you know, overall, what do we still think about, you know, the Killing Joke? Now, I'd be remiss to not mention the animated version of it that try to address all the criticisms that people made, and just made people even more mad because they gave Barbara Gordon, like, this whole big arc in it, like a whole extra, like a third.
It makes it like worse and weirder. It makes it worse.
It upset a lot of people because she ends up, like, having a sexual relationship with Batman, and she was also, like, dating some, she has, like, some flirtation with some criminals. Like, they add a lot of Barbara Gordon stuff to it, but it, like, did not really, like, make the story any better, and upset the same people. So I would, you know, suggest, like, if you're going to try to update Alan Moore, you best not miss, because it just pissed people off more. But I still think this story, even if in the larger context of comic books, it might have had some positive effect. I think Oracle was a good thing, but I think the negative effect of, like, the cumulative effect of how female characters are treated you can definitely make an argument about that being a bad thing. But overall, I still think this is just, like, a fantastic comic and one of my favorite comics, and I always enjoy going back and reading it.
Yeah, I mean, I have my issues, like, exactly what you said. Like, it's also, like, I find it very annoying when people just make broad statements like, I don't like the Killing Joke, because you can't deny the impact that it's, I don't think we'd have, like, even if the Killing Joke isn't your favorite book, but you have a favorite Joker, I can guarantee you that Joker wouldn't exist without the Killing Joke.
Yes, yeah.
You just can't deny the craft, you know what I mean? Like, I do think that there's some weird stuff in this, and I do think that there's a kind of feeling here that, like, you're like that Al, and even Alan Moore in his, like, later interviews is like, I didn't know that they would, like, really let me go that far, you know, but, like, you still can't deny, like, what a well-told story this is. And, like, again, we haven't even talked that much about how gorgeous the artwork is. This is, and also, like, you know, just for a comic to be like, I like this, like, a cool sort of, like, 60 page comic, or this is like an interestingly sized kind of deluxe comic. It's great. It's a great story, even if it's a little bit you know, problematic.
All right, and moving on to Batman Arkham Asylum. Now, I have to be fair, you know, I hadn't read this comic since I first read it maybe 20 years ago, and I didn't really like it the first time I read it, and it's so weird. The thing that annoyed me about it was I didn't like how Joker sexually harassed people in this comic. I thought Joker was, like, too bad and too horny in this comic. It kind of put me off more than, like, the, you know, the serial killer, you know, or the guy slashing his mother open with a razor. It's like, you know what? I really don't think that's the way Joker, you know, would behave in the workplace with Batman. I think he'd be a little bit more respectful of him and his personal space. Now, wow. Reading it again, I realize, you know, that's a little bit silly, and I really enjoyed reading it again. I think it's actually a really strong comic that covers up all the limitations of Grant Morrison by way of Dave McKean's style, art style, where he, what I've said about Grant Morrison before is like, it feels sometimes when you're reading him just on a craft level, like, there are panels missing and he skipped a page and his script is very disjointed. That's deliberate. That works in this one because it is deliberate. Like, there are panels missing and it is disjointed. It's meant to be disjointed, and it works for both Dave McKean's art style and the type of story he's telling about, of, you know, Batman entering Arkham Asylum because Joker has taken it over, and they said, you know, we only need one more person here to be with all us crazies, and that's you, Batman, because you're just as crazy as us. And also, like, this almost kind of this Lovecraftian type story about the origins of Arkham Asylum itself, where they're talking about Jeremiah Arkham, the founder of Arkham, and his descent into you know, celestial madness, as he's dealing with, you know, personal tragedy, his mother dying and being left this big estate that he eventually turns into Arkham Asylum itself. And actually, he does it for good reasons. He's like, I was surprised to read this. He says, you know, I see these, you know, criminals being, they should not be in prison. They should be in a hospital. I'm going to build a hospital for them. Unfortunately, he is haunted by, you know, spectral visions of the great beyond, and he builds like an evil hospital for them. But he is like trying to do some criminal justice reform in this book ultimately.
Yeah, I hadn't remembered that until I revisited it, and that was like, I mean, because that, I think, whereas I completely, you know, Moore's premise of, you know, quote unquote insanity really bothers me, this book is just like, oh, it's so good. I this is one of my favorite books. Like, I think the way they weave like magic and like craziness and like ancestral trauma and how the past, you know, bleeds into the present, and seeing themes pop up in, you know, one person's insanity and then it being related to Kabbalah and stuff. Like, I think you hit the nail on the head that it's like the style and the subject matter really play to Morrison's strengths and hide what he's not always good at.
Yeah, there's not as much of Morrison's like particular obsession with continuity in this book, which I like, actually. This is like this book is like pretty smart. And yeah, also the art in this is like really something else. Like, this is, I like kind of forgot how cool the art is in this book. This is such an interesting comic that like this like very early Morrison work that I believe came out kind of to like because the movie was coming out. They wanted to put out like a prestige, you know, graphic novel Batman story to sort of pair with the movie. And I guess I can't imagine what people who went and saw the Tim Burton Batman of this story.
I think that's what's crazy. Like, it actually feels like a book that would be like written today almost to me. Like,
the art's way ahead of its time too. Yeah.
The art is way ahead of its time. I also just feel how casual it is about like just talking about like deep cut occult shit. It's just like really, really, I mean, it speaks to the whole like British invasion. Like of course Grant Morrison has to put like Kabbalah and tarot into his fucking Batman comic. Yeah. But like, I don't know. I think it feels like 30 years ahead of its time.
Oh, I just read something that, Jack, I'm sorry, I am going to have to ambush you, actually.
Oh, shit.
Morrison has said about the art that he actually would have preferred, this is so pathetic, this is the most pathetic thing I've ever read in my entire life. Oh, he said he actually would have preferred to have Brian Boland
That is actually too pathetic. That is too pathetic that he's like, well, oh, like my take on Killing Joke, I would have preferred the same exact guy. Honestly, this guy has got to stop being like obsessed with Alan Moore. He really must stop.
Yeah.
Yeah, he actually said that he thought that their art, the Morrison's writing and McKean's art style, that they clashed. I'm like,
oh my God,
what are you talking about? This, you should only write books with, you know, Dave McKean. And this is some bullshit he actually put, and it's so fucked up for him to say it, because this is the bullshit he pulled with McKean. He wrote the script without page numbers. Like McKean had to figure like all of this out himself. For people who don't know, a comic book script isn't like a movie script where you have, you know, separate, you know, where you, in a comic book strip, you say what's going to be on each page separately as opposed to designated right. by like scene. And yeah. so, but Grant Morrison didn't do that. He just wrote the whole script out without the page numbers, and McKean figured it out all on his own. And this motherfucker will actually go out and then say, actually, I would like Brian Boland.
Anyway, Jesus. Yeah. I mean, some geniuses need to just keep their mouth shut and stick to what they're good at. I mean, yeah. I think what the only reason this story is effectively told is because of how the novel is constructed. And like, I also think it's like, it shows that everything like a graphic novel, not necessarily everything a graphic novel and comic like should be, but like what you can do with it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
like, I mean, the pages that he wrote for this too, like not only did he not write page numbers, there was twice as much content there. Like he overwrote this because he overwrites everything. And I don't know. I think the, what really works about this book for me is that it's, you know, it's super duper abstract. It's hard to follow. You have to really like some parts of it. If you really want to read every, you know, word written inside of it, you'd need a magnifying glass. But like, it speaks to what you can do with abstract. Like you can sometimes show realism way more effectively by showing like crazy watercolor smears of madness. Like, and I think he doesn't know what makes his work good, and he just needs to be quiet.
Yeah. But yeah, this is, I'm just passing through, because Dave McKean, he was famous for doing the Sandman covers. And, you know, like, I remember seeing those covers and being like, what is this? Can you put that on a comic book cover? Like, is that what, like, I had no idea what was inside the book, because the covers were, you know, made with these, I don't know the artistic term, but made like with real materials that he would patch together and take a photograph of with a drawing of like Morpheus or whatever. And he does, you know, something, you know, very similar stuff too. It's just like it's so textured and layered and so beautiful, and it complements, you know, the somewhat disjointed story where it's jumping back and forth between, you know, this weird, again, of course, Alice in Wonderland type journey for Batman to go into Arkham Asylum by himself without any of the cops back up in order to play this little game with the Joker, who I have to say is very cordial. Aside from the sexual harassment, now he is like, for some reason, this Joker, he woke up this morning and said, I'm just going to be very nice to Batman, and I'm actually not going to shoot that many people or kill that many people. And they make a point in the comic that this joke, like Joker reinvents himself like every single day, depending on what's going on, because that's his way of surviving in the world. I think they use the super sanity when the doctor's talking about them, said uses the super sanity idea, and it kind of explains why we get so many different versions of Joker, who the one who wants to play pranks, the one who's a serial killer, the one who's a gangster. And we get to see a few different facets in this. It's mostly the kind of kooky Joker who's, you know, telling these weird jokes and like patting Batman on the ass type Joker.
I like it when Joker is kind of queer, and like I feel like this book and Dark Knight Returns kind of really lean into that in like a very interesting way. And this one, it's like the kind of like boundaryless like homoeroticism of Batman, the fact that he's like pinching his ass and like calling him darling and stuff, like it just feels, I think, whereas like the like Dark Knight Returns Joker is this like evil, like Charles Nelson Reilly, like type gay guy. Like this is just the unhinged, like no identity. Like it's so interesting too, that it's like, he's reinventing himself every day. He's capable of being the worst version of a Joker, but on this particular day, he's almost more playful. Like, he tricks Batman into thinking that he stabbed a girl in the eye.
Yeah.
And then when he shows up, she's not... Like, I think that's so... It's so unhinged. I love it.
Yeah, it's always, like, cool. It can be more fun sometimes when Joker doesn't kill a person just because, you know? Like, there's several... Like, a lot of writers play with this where Joker will let you think he's about to do the most evil thing, but then the gun is, of course, like, a fake prop gun. That's in the Killing Joke as well. This Joker can be a character that can just be anything that you want him to be. And this helps with like some of the plot holes that pop up in superhero comic books. Like, not necessarily plot holes, but kind of logical inconsistencies where you have, you know, a character like the Joker, you can have him show up and not, you know, murder anybody, and then it's okay that Batman doesn't just kill him outright, right? Because what people, this is one of the earliest hot takes, is like Batman should just kill the Joker outright because he knows he's going to kill a bunch of people, but he actually doesn't. Sometimes Joker just comes around and plays a little prank on a cop, and it's fine, so he doesn't have to kill him.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why this book works, because that's the Batman I want. And it's why, like, I don't really like Batman that much, because I feel like so many people just make him like a cop. Like, and it's why, like, I don't like the Nolan movies really at all. Like, if you go back and rewatch whatever, the one with Bane, it's like what people are like trying, like, what Bane wants to happen is basically, like, to define, like, he wants a nuclear bomb, but he basically is just trying to, like, recreate the social order so, like, people stop suffering, and Batman is just, like, fucking George W. Bush cop. Like,
oh, you mean when the scene when Batman rushes all the bad guys with the cops? That wonderful, wonderful scene in that film where the cops are just straight up his superhero team. Yeah,
it's disgusting. It's in, but I feel like that's the majority. I mean, even the like Burton Batman's like fucking shooting people, and like, I don't know, like, to me, this book, like, it takes the villains, and like, I love how pathetic Two-Face is in this, and like the quote about we're the acid scarred victims of history, and Clayface, I was shit into existence. Like it really kind of, it creates a template where like Batman has to have a level of compassion for these people because they are sick. Like, they may be killers and they may be like horrible monsters of people, but like, I don't know, like, society's made them this way. Like, and they deserve compassion, you know, to the biggest degree. And that's what Batman should represent. He shouldn't just be shoot first, ask questions later.
Yeah, I went back and watched some of Batman the Animated Series because I was on a podcast called Parents Just Don't Understand by our friend of the show, Kurt Schiller. And when you go back and watch that show, like, every single time, like, Batman has to put someone away, like, he has a line about compassion at the end, like, for, you know, the criminal. Like, he's sad and upset, and he's trying to help all these people. You even see some of this in The Dark Knight Returns, at least in the first chapter. Well, I think you kind of see it throughout. You see it in the first chapter with Harvey Dent. You see it with the mutant gang by the end of it, all the teenagers that he turns into his personal fascist military. But, you know, all the juvenile delinquents he was beating up, and now he's, you know, saving them. Very, you really put it well, like, he's not, you know, just like the Joker, because he actually has compassion for all the people he's putting away, and he wants them to get help, and he wants, you know, he has a personal compassion for him. It's not just, I only care about, you know, protecting the victims from the evil type Batman. That Batman, you know, you see a lot of, but is, as you said, there is not as interesting as the Batman who's almost like just a somewhat tough nurse, like keeping, you know, bringing everyone back to the hospital when they get out.
Yeah. And I think I don't know. Like I also I think Killing Joke kind of dances around that too, and Dark Knight Returns too. Like I think like that is when people are really hitting the nail on the head with their dynamic is when Batman realizes he goes too far with Joker. I don't know. I think that's what I want to see. I really love how it's done in this book.
Yeah, I mean, I really, really liked, you know, reading this again. I didn't enjoy it the first time because I just thought, you know, Joker needed to go talk, have like a HR meeting or something. But reading it again, you know, I really think it's just Dave. Apparently, I'm figuring out that we should really be crediting Dave McKean because I am looking through the script and there's so much more in it that McKean like had to edit down into, you know, this really fantastic comic just to have Morrison like talk shit about him for no reason. Like, wow. But I really think it's a fantastic, fantastic book, and really, you know, holds up very well. I think I like it more now than I did in the past.
Yeah, I think it's a great book. I think the art is really cool. I do think it feels so much more modern. It feels very modern, it feels like a comic like that could have come out in the last 10 years or so.
Totally. I mean, like, this is usually actually the book I recommend to people if they, like, don't really like comics but, like, want to get into something. Just because it couldn't be, like, further from, like, a normal comic book.
Yeah.
It's, yeah.
All right. This has been a wonderful conversation. I feel like we need to come back and talk about, you know, some more Joker comics again, Vera. But where can people find you and where can they support the People's Joker?
You can follow me at VeraDrew22 on Twitter, Instagram. People's Joker is currently in pre-production. One thing I didn't touch on in the beginning is when I announced that I was doing it, I opened up the creative process to anybody that would want to contribute, just because I know most of us, you know, we should be staying home still, just beside the fact that everything's opened. Visit thepeoplesjoker.com if you would like to get involved in any way. I'm hoping to make that available at the end of the year. Hoping to have it all done. It's become more of an immense project. Like, when I opened up the creative process, I got like 150 people like that reached out to me, and like, no joke, the majority of them were trans. And I was like, I need to make this good now. Like, I feel like I always was going to like put a lot of care into this, but now it feels like, I don't know, like it's important or something. So I'm taking my time with finishing it, but I'm hoping to, make it available for people to see by the end of the year. So,
well, it sounds like an awesome project. And the trailer that you have up at the people, is it thepeoplesjoker.com?
Yes. Yeah.
At thepeoplesjoker.com. It's fun. It's like such a fun project. And it sounds like, you know, this is like, honestly, what these characters should be used for, is to tell personal stories that break copyright law, is really what I think. I really think that's what we should be doing.
I couldn't agree more. I love superheroes and I love comic books so much, and I just fucking hate most movies about them.
Me too.
Like, I don't know. Like, I know you guys are really anti-Marvel. I like Guardians of the Galaxy, but that's mostly just because I like James Gunn. But, like, I think that's, like, the primary example. Like, I don't need to see any more straight white cis dudes just fucking standing in front of like a bunch of explosions and talking about I hate the self-seriousness and I hate how bland they all are. So
yeah,
copyright infringement's the way to go.
Feels hell like. Yeah. Well, thanks for coming on. It was good to talk to you, and all right, everyone, we'll see you later.
All right, thanks, folks, guys. That was Struggle Session. Have a good one.
It changes you. They say it gives you an affliction like stigmata, but worse. It's called Jokerification. Look it up. Got me Joker 5. Hey, got Joker, got me Joker 5. Hey, got me Joker 5. Hey, giant ogre got me number five. Hey, giant ogre got me number five. Hey, guy saw that shit like a thousand times. Hey, guy took the ketamine to scream. Hey, guy wish I saw that bitch Joaquin. Hey, guy take a sip of his tea. Hey, guy saw that shit like a thousand times. Hey, guy drove it out and took his five. Hey, guy, now I am so drove five. No idea what I'm liable to do. Hey, guy, wanna join my joker crew. Hey, guy. Got me to the fall.